This archival Living World Conversation with Bryant Austin was originally broadcast in May of 2018. The sounds you hear at the lead-in are sung by Judy Collins or an old, haunting, wailing melody. Bryant learned to accept his awareness as a human being, and upon being himself, extended an equivalent right to be to the beautiful ocean creatures who felt safe swimming in the water with him. The whales in turn gifted to Bryant an opportunity to safely come close and photograph them. Welcome, this is William Evans, and we're shifting gears. Our guest today is Bryant Austin. And Bryant Austin is a photographer, and we're sitting in a park in Santa Fe where he's had a major show of his photography. Thank you for talking with us, Bryant.
That's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bryant, tell me about how you learned about whales.
Probably the time I learned about whales was when I first saw dolphins in captivity, and I didn't even know what they were. I didn't know what a dolphin was, and I just saw a very evident suffering. They were in a touch tank. It was very filthy, muddy water, you know, browned, covered in scratches, and they're just barely breathing at the surface, and kids were screaming and yelling and slapping the water, and I just was surrounded by people that seemed oblivious to their suffering, and I was only 6 years old, I think, 5 or 6 years old at the time. And so I didn't know what a dolphin was or a cetacean, which are whales, dolphins, porpoises, but I knew suffering. And I remember just kind of being in a stupor at this marine park for another hour, then I just went into a rage, and my mom had to take me home. Like, I just did not want to be there. I don't even think I was in touch with the rage. I just released all this anger.
Wow. Yeah.
So that was like the very first, you know, inklings of that connection. And it took a long time to wake up to that connection. So I had to build a lot of confidence and self-esteem, which I didn't have when I was young. And it took a long time. It took probably, it took another 30 years to build up the confidence and self-esteem to really take on the subject of a whale.
So it took 30 years for you to accept and be comfortable with the gift of communication that you were able to receive from the dolphin.
Having that undeniable connection, like whatever that is, if I ignore it, I get really depressed. I've been suicidal, hospitalized trying to ignore it. Ultimately, in therapy, I learned I have to. This is my truth, and I need to listen to it, or I'm gonna die young, you know. And my psychiatrist warned me I could have a heart attack or take my own life, and that was in 2006. And so I've been doing this full time ever since.
Talk about the next time you were with a cetacean.
Oh, after that moment as a child,
right?
Yeah, so. I've never seen him in the wild. I saw him in captivity that one time, and then it wasn't until I was 21 years old, and my dad exposed me to sea kayaking, and it's something that really made sense for me because I'm a solitary person, and I like to get away from people. I love to be in nature, and sea kayaking is a great way to do that. And so he took me on my first sea kayaking trip to British Columbia, to Johnstone Strait, which is the inside passage in a very popular area for seeing killer whales. That was the first time I saw a wild cetacean, and There was a moment we were in a two-person kayak where they were swimming up to us in our direction, and we just stopped, and they went around us and under us, and I could see the bottom. It was clear water, so I could see the rocks on the bottom, and I could see this entire killer whale go right under us and vocalize at the same time, so it resonated through the hull of the kayak like a guitar would, like how that sound space would amplify the sound. And we followed them for a little bit, and they stopped to chase salmon into rock cracks. We stopped to observe them chasing salmon, and at one point one spy hopped and looked at us, and they went from like a cute sea panda, like a big intimidating sea panda, to when you saw the eye, they were just completely transformed. You know, there was something there studying you. And yeah, that changed my life.
And then what happened? Talk about those whale experiences during that time.
The first time I got in the water, yeah, that was 1994. I was with the whales in the Azores, and you know, there was no internet back then, and so my only access to the ocean world, especially the ocean world as it's studied, as it's looked at as a form of artistic study, was a magazine called Ocean Realm. And I don't think it's not around anymore. It was a very expensive, beautiful publication, but I don't think it was sustainable. But God, it was beautiful. I saw a small press release in there about a man who does guided trips to swim with whales, and I never heard of such a thing. And I was so excited, I just couldn't believe it. I mean, I was euphoric, and I immediately called the travel agency that coordinates all this for him, and they sent me a stack of brochures. It's just colored paper with printouts. It was very basic, and I saw all the places all over the world that they would go. I couldn't believe it, and so I signed up, and the Azores was the first trip I had done. And it was on a liveaboard sailboat for just, I think, 10 or 11 days. We sailed with two biologists, sperm whale biologists in the Azores, and I had a few opportunities to swim with the whales and really see a lot. It really opened my mind. It was the first time I left the country. It was the second time, and probably the second time I've been on a commercial plane, even though I was jumping out of planes skydiving for years. I'd never been in a commercial plane.
And you were how old?
I was 25.
You trust yourself in this. I would interpret it as a calling from the whales, and you could hear it.
Yeah, I've had dreams about whales.
What did you experience at a communication trust level the first time you swam with the whales?
I think I was just too overwhelmed, and initially, I bought a camera, and you know they were. The biologist saying, you really don't even worry about the camera, because when you first see them, you're not going to believe it, and you're going to, it's going to be overwhelming. And I was like, you know, I've done some pretty crazy things. I think I'll be fine. And sure enough, we got in the water, and a couple of females swam by us, and I forgot about the camera. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was so overwhelming. And, yeah, there is sort of this subconscious trust. You don't even think about it. There are times they do worry me, like, and I know what behaviors to avoid, but, you know, that was 1994, and I wouldn't swim with another whale till 2004. So I did that trip in the Azores, and then my childhood hero, Paul Watson, they accepted my application to volunteer with their organization.
That organization is?
Oh, Sea Shepherd Conservation Society.
Right.
And they're very known for extreme, you know, enforcement of international laws to protect whales and dolphins. And, you know, it was important that I did that, because at the end I was very disillusioned at the end of that year. You know, I guess childhood heroes can often let you down, you know,
yeah,
because we project a lot on them. But it was very educational. I think it was really important. And but at the same time, it really burned me out. It took a couple of years to recover from that. And I recovered by learning sea kayaking, like making a real effort to learn, and kayaking on the ocean every weekend for 2 years.
In Monterey Bay.
Mm-hmm. All over California, from Humboldt to L.A. And then I eventually moved to Santa Cruz.
And then, do I remember right, it was 2004 when you began to swim again?
Yeah,
with whales.
So I think, you know, to back up just a little bit, so I was burned out and kayaked and had a job opportunity in Santa Cruz to be close to the ocean. And by 1998, I realized the only thing I really want to do is commune with marine mammals and study them creatively and to explore the aesthetics of them and their environment. And so I said, you know, just do that. Don't have an agenda. Just explore. And it started from photographing sea otters from a kayak to ultimately getting a 6-meter rigid hull inflatable boat that guy can go far offshore with. And we photographed whales and dolphins above water for a couple of years. And then by 2004, I had been doing it for 2 years and I had nothing. You're trying to bring together, you're trying to find whales and dolphins and align that their behavior up with evocative conditions, sea states, surface states, how it reflects atmospheric states, and really bringing it together in a really evocative way. And so 2 years I had nothing, and I was just going deep into debt. And so the show here, I've been working 2.5 years, and I've made almost 70 photographs already. So it's just so different. And
I read the realization that helped you make the transition from photographing whales to working in Yosemite.
Yeah, and having access to your subject every day.
Right.
It's very important. So I signed up to go to Tonga to swim with humpback whales in 2004, but I was so, I felt I had made a mistake, like that this whole thing was a mistake. You know, I spent a lot of money to looking for these elusive moments to share with humanity. From the boat, the expenses with the boat, I had the first autofocus medium format camera made by Hasselblad. You know, I was just, you know, I was living in a trailer at where I worked. You know, I worked at a Seattle research lab and just really sacrificed everything. Sacrificed my first marriage. It just was, caused a lot of stress. And I was just beginning to feel a lot of regret. And it was too late to refund my trip to Tonga. I didn't want to go. I just wanted to quit everything and rebuild my life. And so I went reluctantly. And that's what changed me, though. That was everything. And
talk about what you experienced, particularly in the context of trust. And what I heard and saw from my research just before I came was that you had a level of comfort with yourself, and that allowed you to be patient and comfortable with the whales as they figured out you were okay to approach.
The one thing I do with whales is I just give them complete space, because they're very curious by nature, and you've got to give them space to let them explore their natural curiosity. And so that's very at the core of it. And people often say I'm very patient, but I realized during this show that it's not patience. It's my truth. I'm in complete harmony with my purpose, and so there's no resistance. So when you're in perfect alignment with your truth, there's no resistance. So patience doesn't even enter into it. You're just there's no resistance, and you're completely there in the moment.
What I hear you telling me is that you've realized just during this show here in Santa Fe that your truth is inherent trust.
Yeah, and it's true with the sun and all the work I've done. Like when this event happens that I've waited 6 months or a year for, and my camera jams, and by the time I reboot my camera, the moment's gone. That even then I don't. There's no patience. There's no losing. You know, getting impatient or resisting. It's okay. Like this is my flow. This is my truth. There's no resistance. And I don't know how else to describe it. But, you know, if I'm in traffic or in my computer, I get the wheel of death on my computer, then I start to get impatient, you know? So.
Well, there's so much confusion and lack of trust in the world we live in right now. And
I know.
A lack of truth.
Right.
So that people don't know who to believe or what to believe, and that becomes a paralyzing, desperate state.
Really bad right now. There's no regulation on dissemination of news now. It's just a free-for-all.
And so you're anchored in a very unforgettable and profound experience with realizing you you go into sacred time when you're with the whales.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the clock doesn't have anything to do with what's happening.
No, I mean, and clock time's an illusion anyway, and it really melts away when I'm with them or with other subjects that really resonate with me.
So that's a scarce experience for particularly males in this culture.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's critical to making life-sustaining choices.
Right, right. Yeah, for me, my life-sustaining choice wasn't a monetary one. I don't let that, no matter how stressful it might feel, like I never let that govern my decisions as an artist. And really as someone who wants to thrive and stay alive and thrive. And I think when you do that, you it's rough, and you kind of live on the fringe of society. Like, you know, for me, I was single for 9 years, you know, and I realize it's nothing personal. It's not that I have no value or as a partner, it's just that our values are different. My values are different from most people, most women that would want to have a relationship. You know, it's like, yeah. But I think, yeah, that's the first step for me in a sustainable existence, is aligning with your truth and your purpose.
Well, it's rare to align with your truth at the level where money doesn't influence your decisions.
I see it ruin so many artists and just so many people's lives. I see it ruin our ecology, our economy. You know, I've had to live with my mom. I've lived in my van, you know, when I had one. You know, I was looking at just being homeless and living in nature, you know, for a while until I could figure things out. But.
So let's go back to whales.
Yeah.
And you're listening to KDNK. This is Shifting Gears, and we're in a conversation with Bryant Austin, a photographer, and particularly we're talking with him about his experience making friends with whales, being comfortable with them, and their being comfortable with him, and the photographs that resulted from that experience. So tell me about the physical encounters and the... Were you snorkeling with the whales mostly?
Yeah, it's a monsnorkel. Whales don't like bubbles. And when you use a snorkel, you can get in and out of the water quickly, up to 20 times a day, because I'm usually on the water for 10 hours. So you get in and out of the water rapidly to assess behavior and to see if it's a safe behavior, to see how they respond to you. And so there's that too.
Listen, observing from up there?
Oh, I'm in the boat, so
okay.
I'll leave the boat momentarily to look around, see what they're doing, and then I may stay with them. I work alone with them. They're more likely to come up to you if you're by yourself. So yeah, the snorkel, free diving is my passion. So it just makes more sense. Scuba creates a lot of bubbles. Bubbles are a threat display to whales and dolphins, and they're just very cumbersome. It's like wearing a spacesuit. We're aquatic animals. We don't need it.
So talk about some of the physical interaction that you experienced that led to, and tell us where it led in terms of the quality and the kind of photography you're doing with whales when you do that.
Yeah, you know, I'd spent years photographing whales above water. I had a boat dedicated to that purpose and a team of volunteers, and we spent years trying to align cetacean behavior with really evocative sea surface states and atmospheric conditions and light, and I never achieved anything during that 4-year period. And photographing them underwater I was at a complete loss. I had no inspiration to photograph them underwater. Because I would never swim up to them to get close, that didn't even enter into my mind as a possibility. So I just thought, why take more photos of them underwater that are derivative, you know, and unoriginal and aren't going to move the needle for humanity? So it wasn't until I was in Tonga in 2004 and I reluctantly went to swim with them underwater, and I really didn't want to go because I had just gone, you know, really deep in depth photographing them above water, you know, 4 years and really no photographs, and just it was a bit maddening. And so in 2004, when I reluctantly made that decision to swim with them, that's when I received the inspiration from them. That's when I saw what was possible.
And to be clear about what you saw was possible, you saw the opportunity to photograph them at a very close distance.
Yeah, they came up to me, and that's never happened before. They came up to me probably 3 feet away, so close that, you know, I had to put the camera down at the end when this young calf's fluke came right by, inches by my mask, and probably would have brushed up against my camera had I left it in position. And at that distance, you see their true color. You see their skin and musculature flex over their frame as they power their fluke. You see their eye moving in its socket as they study you, and the parasites crawling on them. So that happened with that calf, and what happened next is just reinforced it. That inspiration was, I felt a tap on my shoulder, and it was too solid to be human, and I just felt dread. I think I knew it was Mom. I had a feeling it was her, and I looked, and she was right behind me, looking at me, and her pectoral fin is 15 feet long and weighs 2 tons. She touched me with the very tip of it. It would be like the tip of your middle finger. And had she touched me with the leading edge of her fluke, she would have broke my back. So she just grazed me just to let me know. She was very gentle, and I was humbled by that. I was physically shaking afterwards, trying to process everything I saw. And that's when I realized that the one thing I could do, the one thing that has never been done before, certainly hasn't been done since, is this idea of making high-resolution, one-to-one, life-size portraits of whales with calm expressions in their eye, very calm, curious expressions, and that comes from when they come up to you. If you swim up to them, they're going to have often an expression of distress, so that's not inspiring. So that's where it started, and I wanted to give that to humanity, and yeah.
How many photographs will go into a composite of a whale?
I have 3 full-body composites, and the number of photographs range from 15 to 30.
And how long does it take you to put those together and integrate a full life-size whale picture?
It depends. It depends. I have to make a purpose-built computer to handle the file sizes. They're massive. The first one took 2 months to build the computer and then finish the composite. And my last one is 8 by 36 feet. That took 6 months to build the computer and then 6 months to finish it. It's my largest file. It was completed in 2012. It's never been printed or finished to museum standards. From 2012, I spent another 3 years just trying to raise funds to print and mount it to museum standards. And that's when I reluctantly stopped and decided I need to create again. I can't do this.
You realized that you didn't have the financial resources and the time to...
And it was draining me.
To do what you could do with whales.
Yeah, it was corrosive to the creative part of my mind, being a salesman every day and not creating. So I had to take a break, yeah.
But you did get these pictures that you did complete.
Yeah.
To some of the whaling countries.
I did. It wasn't that I thought I could end whaling. What I was really interested in is I wanted to share the work with what I thought would be the most challenging audiences, you know, in countries where the issue of whaling is highly polarized and toxic. And I thought if people were moved here, that this is a worthwhile practice to pursue and really address the real issues. Whaling represents less than 1% of what's killing whales, and what the thing that's killing whales is our lifestyle. Our lifestyle choices are killing whales. in record numbers, our love of seafood, our use of single-use disposable plastic is destroying the ocean. Cheap goods from overseas and the shipping industry that supports it is acidifying our ocean. So those are the issues I really wanted to touch upon, but I initially shared in Norway and Japan just to see how people would respond. And we had incredible attendance, incredible moments with viewers. In Norway, I met with whalers who came to the show. I think the press wanted to kind of stir some controversy and some drama. And the whalers were moved to silence, and we had a very respectful conversation. And they couldn't believe how I told them I made the photographs and the trust I had in that creature. You know, they could not believe it.
So you stood there in silence with them?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't believe in polarizing. And I want to listen. I want to give them space. And yeah.
And how long would that space sometimes be?
I'm trying to recall. It could be a minute, you know, which feels like a long time.
It can be when you're standing next to someone and neither of you are saying anything.
Yeah, we were just kind of looking at the photographs together.
Right.
Yeah.
And then what would happen?
I just recall just them being silent and just us having a conversation about how they were taken and just seeing the expressions on their face about how I let them come to me so close, you know. Sometimes, like with sperm whales, you know, how their mouth would be open underneath my body and I have to be careful not to let my foot go inside their mouth because they might want to feel it and just touch it. They were shaking their heads. They couldn't believe it. You know, I don't think they look at whales that way. They don't think of them. I'm sure they probably have nightmares about being in the water with them. You know, like, that's the last thing they would want. You know, and so it was an interesting experience.
Well, what I hear is that the silence and the spaciousness that you granted to the whales...
Right.
You granted to the whalers.
Yeah, you granted to everybody, yes.
And they glided away and had the experience to process.
Absolutely. If I told them how awful they are to kill whales, how dare they, I'm completely robbing them of their freedom to explore the emotional spectrum of viewing them in this way. And
well, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
This is KDNK. You've been listening to a conversation with Bryant Austin and his experiences learning to be with whales. Thank you for listening.